Douglas Adams was born on March 11, 1952, in Cambridge, England. He died in Hollywood, California, on May 11, 2001, after a heart attack at a gym where he had been running on a treadmill. In the intervening 49 years, he wrote for stage, radio, television, theater, and the internet, as well as novels, comic books, CD-ROMs, and computer games. His biggest influences were Monty Python, the Beatles, and the British science fiction series Doctor Who. Douglas Adams' biggest hit was the BBC radio science fiction comedy series The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a truly remarkable book. The introduction starts like this. Space, it says, is big, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the street to the chemist, but there's
M.J.
just
Simpson has written a
peanuts to
biography
space.
of Douglas
Listen.
Adams, creator of The
Wow.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy,
Wow. It
and
starts
he's in
out
the
sounding
studios of the
and it starts
BBC
getting
in Leicester,
intellectual.
England. Welcome so much to the program.
Thank you.
The official first broadcast date of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy on BBC Radio was when?
That was 10:30 in the evening on the 8th of March, 1978. I'm not normally that precise, but it's rather ingrained itself in my consciousness after having written the book. But it just caught on instantly.
There are some stock characters in the series. The first being Arthur Dent. He's an Earthman who hitches a ride on a spaceship when Earth explodes. He's kind of an everyman. The book in the series, the original series, which started all of this, after this radio series, there were the novels and there was the TV adaptation. But one of the main focuses is this book.
What to do if you find yourself stuck in a crack in the ground underneath a giant boulder you can't move with no hope of rescue? Consider how lucky you are that life has been good to you so far. Alternatively, if life hasn't been good to you so far, which given your current circumstances seems more likely, consider how lucky you are that it won't be troubling you much longer.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was actually an electronic book and you could research it. And it now looks, with the benefit of hindsight, like Douglas was remarkably prescient. And we have little PDAs and we have wireless Bluetooth connection to the internet and all sorts of stuff. But Douglas wasn't predicting that. What he really needed was, he was writing this radio series, he needed a narrator. And you're not supposed to use narrators in radio. They're rather frowned on as the easy way out. So he came up with the idea of this talking guidebook.
Could a mere computer solve the problem of life, the universe, and everything? Fortunately for posterity, there exists a tape recording of what transpired when the computer was given this particularly monumental task. Arthur Dent stops off in Slaty Bartfast's study to hear it.
What is this great task for which I deep thought?
The one important thing that underpins the whole story is this great quest which a race of pan-dimensional beings have to find out the great answer to the question of life on Earth and everything, and it turns out to be 42. It's such a wonderful anticlimax, a great non sequitur. You've got the answer, and you still don't know what it means, because you don't know what the question is.
The answer to everything.
Yes?
Life, the universe.
Yes.
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 42.
Being involved in a science fiction series, he has the prerequisite robot, except this is Marvin. He's sort of the Eeyore of space travel.
I think you ought to know I'm feeling very depressed.
God.
Marvin the paranoid android is very comparable to Eeyore, and Douglas actually sort of didn't realise that at the time, and I believe it was Douglas's mother who many years later said to me, Douglas, Marvin's really just a robotic Eeyore, isn't he? And, yes, I see it. I mean, Hitchhikers is part of that great tradition of English whimsy, A.A. Milne and Lewis Carroll, but everybody loves Marvin.
What do you want?
Give Zay for the yell, will you?
Mind-taxing time again, is it?
Just get on with it.
I've just worked out an answer to the square root of minus one.
Go and get Zaphod.
It's never been worked out before. It's always been thought impossible.
Go and get...
I'm going. Pausing only to reconstruct the whole infrastructure of integral mathematics in his head. He went about his humble task, never thinking to ask for reward, recognition, or even a moment's ease from the terrible pain in all the diodes down his left side. Fetch Beeblebrox, they say, and forth he goes.
He even had his own fan club in the early 80s. There was a thing called the Marvin Depreciation Society. He even recorded a couple of pop records.
Oh, no.
Stephen Moore, who did the voice, recorded a couple of sort of electro-pop 80s songs in the character of Marvin.
Long ago, in another galaxy, there lived a gloomy robot. His name was Marvin. He was getting old and a bit rusty, and nobody liked him.
Did Douglas Adams have a theme? You know, was there a beginning, a middle, and an end in mind? Or was he making it up as he went along, working episode to episode?
He was very much making it up as he went along. Beginnings, middles, and endings is what all good stories should have. Well, Douglas was great at beginnings. He was pretty good at middles. He couldn't do endings, mainly because by the time he got to the middle, he'd thought of another really good beginning, and he wanted to go and write that instead of doing the ending of something. Douglas's propensity for just not finishing writing by the time of the deadline is legendary. Producers and editors and publishers very rapidly found the only way to get him to write was to sit him down with a typewriter, or in later years a word processor, and just literally stand there looking over him and just not letting him go off and do anything else until he'd written the requisite number of pages. Second radio series, I mean, it was quite legendary. They had to get these five episodes done, and on at least one occasion an actor had turned up to play a part. That scene hadn't been written yet, so he played another part and went home because he had something else to do, and they had to get somebody else in to play the other part. I interviewed Jeffrey Perkins, the producer, and he was talking about the rush to get these very last couple of episodes done. I mean, they were literally editing the final episode about half an hour before it was due to go out on the BBC.
Do you realise that robot can hum like Pink Floyd? What else can you do, Marvin?
Rock and roll.
Did these series create a buzz and a word of mouth? Partly because of the way it was produced. I mean, there's the Beatle influence, the music. Pink Floyd was a big influence on him. What was the series actually conceived in some ways as a Wow Man stereo recording?
Absolutely. Traditionally, BBC radio comedy is funny line, funny sound effect, funny line, a twang or a plop, but there was no real sense of an all soundscape. And Douglas was very, very influenced by rock music of the 60s and 70s. He was a huge fan of the Beatles, a huge fan of Pink Floyd, and these great overproduced albums, Salt and Pepper and everything that came after it, where creating sounds that you couldn't recreate live, and he wanted a radio series that sounded like that. Paddy Kings and Dick Mills and Harry Parker in the legendary BBC Radiophonic Workshop, who this amazing avant-garde experimental workshop of electronic music, produced fantastic sounds for it. And the music, a lot of the music in the first series is actually out of Douglas Adams' record collection. You have people like Brian Eno and Tomita and Ligeti. And Douglas really was very involved in how this programme sounded. And that's an important part. Over and above the ideas and the jokes and the sparkling dialogue, the sound is so rich and so deep that it made it sound like nothing else.
We are now cruising at a level of 2 to the power of 25,000 to 1 against unfalling. And we will be restoring normality as soon as we are sure what is normal anyway. Thank you. 2 to the power of 20,000 to 1 against and falling.
Arthur, this is fantastic. We've been picked up by a ship with the new infinite improbability drive. I mean, this is really incredible, Arthur. Arthur? What's happening?
Ford, there's an infinite number of monkeys outside who want to talk to us about this script for Hamlet they've worked out.
He always had a fondness for gadgets, whether it was a new camera or a new guitar. He was, of course, a passionate advocate of the Apple Macintosh, and every new Apple Mac that came out, he got it as soon as he could. I mean, he was either the first or second person to have an Apple Mac in the UK. But also, Douglas had this really refreshing attitude to technology, and he could see when it was foolish, he could see when it worked. There's the famous story of the video phone at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He went to MIT once, and they said, we've got this video phone we're trying to develop. This is mid-80s. There was no technology to actually send a video image down the line. So what they'd invented was a device which had a little digitized picture of somebody who might call you regularly. And then as the sound came out of the telephone, it would move the mouth to match the sounds. And Douglas said, well, this is horrible. You know, you could have this nice grinning photograph of your sister and she's telling you that your mother's just died. It's completely missing the point. And he could see that. He could see what the point was, which people getting really involved in the technology could sometimes lose track of. And he was very respected for that.
What was Douglas Adams' point of view? What was his philosophy of life, as it were?
I guess his philosophy of life, it was very, very humanist. It was very ecological. I mean, he became passionate about nature and ecology and what is happening to the planet, what's happening to the world. He wrote a wonderful book. The only non-fiction book he ever wrote is called Last Chance to See. And it was his favourite of all his books. And most people who've read the full canon of his work, it's their favourite. It's certainly mine. It's a wonderful account of an expedition or a series of expeditions over a couple of years, which he and a zoologist called Mark Carwardine went round the world to look for endangered species. He really cared about people as an integral part of the world, and he had enormous perspicacity. He could see how we fit into the world, how everything else fits into the world, and how it all got to fit together. When you start damaging or losing bits of it, it has a knock-on effect. That was certainly his philosophy, very much an ecological, humanist, compassionate philosophy about the world.
M.J. Simpson is the author of a new biography of Douglas Adams. Douglas Adams created The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The biography is called Hitchhiker. M.J. Simpson joined us from the studios of the BBC in Leicester, England. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
There's more on Douglas Adams, including the full interview with biographer M.J. Simpson, on our website, npr.org. This is NPR's Weekend Edition, directed by Ned Wharton, with production help from Neil Carruth, Phil Harrell, and David Rector. Stu Seidel is the senior editor. The senior producer is Robert Maleski. Our audio engineers today are Greg Gavin and Ted Mebane. Key Maleski is the reference librarian. And today we lose our longtime assistant producer and puzzle mistress, Wilma Consul. She wins her weekends because she's taking her talents and hot sauce to Morning Edition. So aloha, Wilma, and thanks for everything. Our theme music was written by B.J. Lederman, with additional music from Steph Scajari and Greg Smith. I'm Leanne Hansen.